Good afternoon. I guess I'm in the same boat as the last gentleman, and I've never been here before. I guess I thought you'd be further away.
We can back up a little.
Hi.
We'll be nice.
An introduction to this case. This was a case where it was a money judgment had been requested, and some 4 months prior to this incident in question, creditors' interrogatories had been served upon the clients of Attorney Morris directly, as opposed to going through the attorney of record. Unbeknownst to opposing counsel, the answers to the creditors' interrogatories could not be downloaded by electronic service due to volume problems or something of that nature. Therefore, when this rose its head some 4 months later, it certainly wasn't anything Attorney Morris, number one, was really even expecting, because she had thought that the case had basically closed itself with the filing of the creditors' interrogatories, and the opposing counsel could take whatever measures he wanted to capitalize on recovering his money judgment. One of the big issues here is that the judge's order, which was originally Judge Prince, I feel like it was not a valid order. It was an order that was sent out by e-service on a case that my client essentially figured was over. And the order stated for my client to appear in 7 days. My client was not personally served, which is an absolute requirement under Rule 107.
Also, I want to stop you there because to me that's a pretty important issue, is the personal service issue. The rule doesn't use the word personal. The rule uses the word direct service. Why should we equate direct service with personal service when we know that, for instance, in other rules, when the rule intended to require personal service, it uses the word personal. Here it doesn't.
Well, in all contempts, they are required to be personally served. We're not talking about Rule 5.
No, Rule 107.
And it also, a part of that is there's a 20-day time frame. So there are both those inconsistencies.
And on the 20-day time frame, the order you're talking about was an order with respect to a show cause order directed to the clients, not to Ms. Morris, isn't that correct, in terms of the contempt show cause?
There have been two orders. The first one was for Ms. Morris and her clients to appear. And then there was a second one for just Ms. Morris to appear to answer to why she had not appeared previously.
But in terms of a contempt show cause order, the first one only was directed to the clients, was it not?
I'm sorry?
Wasn't that directed only to the clients and not to Ms. Morris? She was to appear, but...
The second one was directed to Ms. Morris to appear. And okay. Answer why she did not appear previously.
All right.
So I'm sorry if there's some confusion there. The first one was for her and her clients, and then the second one was for her personally. So.
And that one did have more than a 20-day period, did it not?
After some debate about it, there was a July 22nd date, then a July 28th date, and a July 28th date gave the August 31st date. And so originally no, and then it was remedied down the road. But again, there was no personal service, there was no citation that was served on Ms. Morris stating what it was she had done.
Well, could I stop you a minute and go back to Judge Jones's question? The word directly was added in 94-95 to the rule. Instead of served upon, served directly upon, now appears the word directly.
And I agree with you. However, take the case of a child support enforcement. the person is served personally. They may be in a divorce proceeding, and...
In a contempt action and something like that? Okay.
They still have to be served directly. And why should an attorney be held to a different standard just because they're an attorney?
What is indirect about serving somebody by electronic means or even by mail? What's indirect about it? It's not going through another person, really. I mean, well, especially on a computer. I mean, we're just going over some phone lines or something.
And I'm sure I don't understand exactly what you're asking.
Well, the question is, the rule says directly. It doesn't say personally. You seem to be saying you have to take a physical piece of paper and hand it to the person, and that's the only possible means of service. And it seems to me you're just relying upon what practice maybe is. I'm trying to get to what directly means. It said, because the rule says directly. And she was served by this e-filing system. Why is that indirect? Why isn't that direct?
I believe that maybe we are talking about practice. And in all the cases I've ever done on a contempt, the person is personally served and is given the notice requirements.
Well, if I could interrupt, I'm sorry to interrupt, but if we take the word directly out, the rule would say the citation, a copy of the motion, affidavit, and order shall be served upon such person. By adding that word directly, the Supreme Court seems to be communicating something different than just service. And then the follow-up question to that has to do with your position on this and the notice, the requirement.
I think if they meant e-service was fine, they would have said e-service. They didn't say e-service. They said direct service. And
would it be indirect service if service were made only on the affected client's counsel, for example?
I'm sorry, I missed the beginning.
Well, could directly mean that you would have to serve the individual who is actually the subject of the contempt proceeding, perhaps by email as well, but that the contrast is you couldn't simply serve that person's attorney.
I agree with that.
And does that mean that directly here we have the Ms. Morris is the one affected by the order, and she was served directly, that is, by the email. Why wouldn't that be a reasonable reading?
Because I don't believe that that is what was contemplated when they put by direct service. I think that, like I stated, if they wanted it to be by e-service, they would have stated it be by e-service, and that the courts could, like I stated, sua sponte, in this case, issue all kinds of orders. The burden on attorneys becomes so great to a point where we're to be checking electronic telecommunications all the time. That would never account for being sick, would never account for being out of your office, being in some other matter. What if she had a week-long criminal trial? I know I get caught up in other things. And to me, a direct service would be maybe the court clerk calling up and saying, something happened in this case. Check your email filings. Check your e-service. Something to that effect. But there is no requirement that I know of that we are to check our LexisNexis every day. And especially on a case which you think is closed. So in a criminal case, by Rule 54, we're immediately released after sentencing. My feeling had always been I represented my clients for evermore unless I filed a motion to withdraw. I found out since that that's not accurate. Yet, all the time, I receive in the mail a notice to revoke when my clients haven't complied. So there needs to be some type of consensus amongst all this type of service, and I think a contempt is the most egregious one.
Let me stop you again if I could. We're talking about the July 15th order that is the subject of this contempt, correct?
Correct.
And there would have to be proof would you agree, beyond a reasonable doubt, that your client had actual notice of that order?
I believe that would be accurate.
Well, that's different than what we're talking about service. Now we're talking about the actual notice element.
And I believe in the orders that the judge states that she should have known, not that she did have notice.
And what evidence is in the record to support that?
Well, one of the problems we have here is there's no recording. And unfortunately, that's a situation that how do we make it up if we don't agree? I do think a few things that we do agree on is that it was an indirect contempt and that it was for money judgment. I believe that the creditors' interrogatories had been answered. Outside of that, I'm not sure what Mr. Finkelstein and I do agree on, except for what's stated in his briefs. But when I look at the judge's orders, the first one on contempt of November 2nd, 2009, I find that to be quite different from her order on a motion to set aside and for reconsideration. I would also state to the court that e-service to me is, while a very interesting tool, not an imperfect tool. I am constantly barraged with orders that come in that are written on top of each other, and half the time I don't even know what the case is. And sometimes
go to my specific question. What evidence was there to support the actual notice that your client had actual notice of that July 15th order?
The court stated in her order that the motion to set aside the reconsideration, under paragraph number one, the court finds that there was a valid order for Cynthia Morris, counsel for the defense, to appear before the court on July 22nd. And that was within the 7-day time frame. The order was electronically served upon Ms. Morris, both by the court and by Mr. Doherty, via LexisNexis File and Serve. Ms. Morris testified she did not receive actual notice of the order to appear on July 22nd. The court accepts her statement as true, but concludes actual notice is not required under the unique circumstances of the case. So what do you get? Constructive notice? I mean, somehow you have to know about a proceeding before you can do anything.
What happens if an email is sent to an attorney and it's evident that it was actually received but not opened? That means that the attorney cannot be exposed to any sanctions simply by not having opened an email?
Well, and I think in that case, Judge, you have to look at what is placed on the pleadings, and if it states that an attorney accepts pleadings by email. I have discontinued that because I am running at the speed of light as a sole practitioner to keep up with all these new means. And it is just physically impossible, which is part of the reasons why I believe the legislature, in their infinite wisdom, gave you the time requirements in which to respond to certain different criteria. Because it's impossible for one person to field all the emails, the LexisNexis, and the faxes, and everything else that's coming in. So I would like to reserve the rest of my time. I know it's not
okay.
Much,
about a minute.
Bye.
May it please the court. Leo Finkelstein on behalf of the District Court of El Paso County. I'd like to make sure there's no confusion here, so I'm going to go and talk
Good.
About the orders. The July 15 order was an order to show cause to clients, Ms. Morris's clients, to appear on July 22. But it was also an order for Ms. Morris to appear. It was served electronically, as well as an electronic notice of hearing. So she received two notices to appear, both of which were served pursuant to Rule CRCP 5 and the electronic, it would be 5 B2D, but it's the electronic service provision. And that provision says that parties who have subscribed to e-filing, which Ms. Morris had, it's evident for the entire case, and she entered her appearance in 2007, and she has subscribed to e-filing, have agreed to receive e-service, and it's complete on transmission. So the issue with respect to notice of the July 15 order, which is what Judge Furman, you're getting to.
Right.
I argue on behalf of the district court that she received legal notice. That was not a contempt citation to her. So that's why I want to differentiate that from the later due process issues. That's a valid court order served electronically, both by counsel and by the court. So two different electronic notices to her.
But you agree there has to be proof she had actual notice of that order?
I would agree with the following. When one reads the case law says you have to have actual notice to be held in criminal contempt.
Being contempt is a drastic, important, but drastic remedy.
I agree with that. And I do agree with the general concept that an attorney has to have notice of the proceedings before the attorney is going to be held in
contempt. Notice of the order.
Notice of the order. The concern I have is that when can you impute notice in any way, shape, or form to the attorney when it's served twice by electronic means, and the rules of civil procedure state that service is effective upon transmission. At that point in time, my argument on behalf of the district court is she has notice to appear, legal, sufficient notice under the rules.
Even though the court accepted her statement, she didn't have actual notice. And she didn't have actual notice, and the court accepted that.
The court did.
Doesn't that, in effect, end the inquiry by saying that she couldn't be held in criminal contempt?
Well, the court accepted that, but then the court went on to state that kind of a concept, that because the attorney can come in and say, gee, I didn't get it, or I couldn't open it, I mean, there's different possibilities, would defeat the orderly administration of justice because the court relies on attorneys to check their e-filings. And the problem with that is that Ms. Morris had, in the past, both failed to appear and failed to respond to pleadings with the same excuse of not getting e-file documents.
Okay, well then let me stop you a minute, because the court certainly made those findings, but that's not even a ground for a contempt, right? I mean, the rule itself says the conduct must be found to be offensive to the authority and dignity of the court. See, and the trouble that I'm having, aside from the sufficiency, mm-hmm. is if an attorney doesn't comply with timelines in a rule, with not knowing a pleading is served at a certain time, there's a lot of ways to deal with that. Mm-hmm. And certainly John Gleason's office, I could just envision a lot of ways. But in this type of a case, we're dealing with a punitive sanction, what used to be a criminal contempt action. Mm-hmm. And the rule itself says it has to be offensive to the authority and dignity of the court, not disrupt the administration of justice and those kinds of things. That's irrelevant under the rule itself. And that's my concern here.
I agree in principle, but what happened is when she failed to appear, the judge, Prince, sua sponte, issued the order to show cause, and he directed plaintiff's counsel to draft the actual motion for contempt citation. And plaintiff's counsel did so, and plaintiff's counsel in the actual motion that was electronically filed, and then the order to show cause that subsequently issued, the actual contempt citation, if you will, he referred to the pattern of contempt, the pattern that had happened. So when the case went to trial, both matters, if you will, are called the two matters, but the pattern went to trial as well as the actual initiating conduct that caused Judge Prince to sua sponte issue the order to show cause.
But the pattern would still have to be proven by actual notice. In other words, of a past
yes.
event where she would have had to have had notice and did not appear.
And
aside from the willful and all the other elements that go into a contempt.
I agree with that, but the pattern was in the motion for contempt citation filed by the plaintiff's counsel, and it was the basis for the actual order to show cause issued on July 28. The motion on July 27 was electronically filed. The order to appear, which is the actual contempt citation, was filed by the court electronically on July 28. And on July 30, Ms. Morris, in response to the warrants that had been issued against her clients, filed a motion to quash warrant. It's on page 186 of the CD-ROM, in which she says the court has scheduled a hearing to prosecute the order to show cause issued to defense counsel on August 31, 2009. So in point of fact, it's a written acknowledgement by her that she's received, and if you will, has actual notice of the motion for contempt and citation that was issued, and an acknowledgement that she has more than 20 days to respond. So the question, I want to get to the second one just before I run out of time, but on the actual contempt citation and going to hearing on it, she's acknowledged receipt, even though it wasn't personally served by someone handing it to her. It was served electronically. She has acknowledged receipt. She appeared that August 31 date was vacated and reset to September 22 for an advisement. She appeared at the advisement. She did not file a motion to quash service. She appeared at the hearing. She did not ask to quash service, which gave the court personal jurisdiction. She did not object to the jurisdiction over her. And the concept of notice and an opportunity to be heard, meaning the proper service of a paper on you, whether it's direct, whether it's by personal service, all comes out of due process, notice of an opportunity to be heard. So my argument there is when she acknowledges receipt and does not come in and say the manner of receipt was improper, the manner of service was improper, like I want to quash it, she waived any objections, and she did not raise it with the district court. That's a different issue than what you asked earlier, which is whether there's actual notice. If there's the most difficult question in this case is whether you can impute to an attorney actual notice by two electronically filed documents telling her to appear when that method of service has been approved by the Supreme Court electronically.
You don't have the record, obviously, of the actual hearing.
That's true.
Would that be necessary to determine what her explanation was at the time? For example, whether it was a screw-up of the LexisNexis system, totally unrelated to any conduct?
It's not necessary. That was her explanation. As a prosecuting attorney, I was there, and her explanation was, I didn't get it. There was something wrong with my LexisNexis.
And was that it? And is that what was accepted by the court?
That was accepted by the court. I didn't get it. But the court's,
but she could still be held in contempt if it were the fault of the LexisNexis?
If one had evidence to that effect, then I think that would be a problem. But there was no evidence presented to that effect. And in point of fact,
but I thought the judge accepted it. That, I mean, that's a credibility question, not lacking any evidence. You're agreeing there was evidence to support that.
It's very interesting to read the judge's rulings because
it is.
In paragraph 3, the court notes Ms. Morris did not call any witness or present any documentation.
Does she have to call witnesses in a punitive contempt
action? She testified, didn't she?
She testified. That's correct. But it says, nor did she provide any documentation from LexisNexis or her email provider.
Does she have to? This is a criminal, what used to be called a criminal action.
No, she does not have to. She doesn't even have to testify.
So the judge is shifting the burden on that?
No, I would not agree with that. I think the judge is commenting that no evidence was presented to the court. The primary evidence that was presented of her.
But in paragraph 1, let me go back, and I'm interrupting you a lot, and I'm sorry for that, but obviously, I'm concerned about this. Paragraph 1, the judge seems to be making credibility findings.
What the court does is she says the court accepts her statement as true that she did not receive actual notice of the order to appear. It's not really a credibility finding. She accepts that statement as true. So she goes on to conclude that actual notice is not required under the unique circumstances of this case. And the reason she says so is because the LexisNexis file and serve system has been deemed by the Supreme Court to be sufficient for the service of an order upon an attorney.
I guess the problem here on this particular issue is it's not clear from the court's finding as to whether the court accepted why she didn't get the notice. The court accepted that she did not get actual notice.
Right.
And it's unclear from the order whether the court accepted her explanation as to why that was. The court could have believed that she simply didn't pay attention and didn't read her emails and such, but we don't know, do we?
We do have in finding number two, a statement by the court. The court also finds that Ms. Morris's explanation of why she failed to appear on July 22nd and other occasions was not credible.
That's correct.
But we don't know
that. Has nothing to do with her contempt.
Well, it depends on what your interpretation is of how the court dealt with the pattern of contempt that was also part of this. And I think therein lies the frustration. There's failure to appear on multiple occasions. Even when the judgment was entered, she didn't appear on October 30. And in these pleadings, she indicates that she received email notification that the court had entered an order, but never opened the order to see what it said. And all the court had done was continue the proceeding to October 30th. She figured, oh, it must have been granted, didn't open it. Then the court enters a judgment, gives her 10 days to say, why weren't you here? And she never responds to that either. Eventually, the court enters judgment, and 6 months later, she files a motion saying, I didn't know all this was happening.
Now, assuming we see a pattern here,
yes,
I'm going back to the punitive sanctions, the old criminal contempt idea. Do you agree that there has to be proof beyond a reasonable doubt or evidence rising to the level of beyond a reasonable doubt for a court to impose punitive sanctions?
I agree with that.
And
the element that's required.
And you would agree with that?
Yes.
And that includes element of actual notice.
The difficulty I have with that proposition, acting on behalf of the court, is what constitutes actual notice. And the issue for you, and I have to admit, as far as I know, it's an issue of first impression, is does two electronic service filings and service of the order of the court twice, does that constitute actual notice to a lawyer? Or does someone have to come in and prove that the lawyer actually received that order and knew about it?
You're sort of drawing a distinction between actual notice and actual knowledge.
I am. And I think that I used the word in my brief legal notice that what's required when a judge issues an order, is that he notify counsel. He does so in electronic filing cases by electronically filing and serving that order. And in this case, plaintiff's counsel also did that. So it was done twice. And so on behalf of the district court, I'm equating, as Judge Bromley did, legal notice. If you read Judge Bromley's decision, I think I took the words from her decision that she found there was legal notice. And that is, in fact, actual notice.
You agree there has to be a finding of willful failure to comply?
I do agree with that.
And what evidence supported the willfulness? Not the pattern, but with respect to the July 15th.
That's a more difficult question, but the answer to
that... There's a lot of difficult questions.
It is. The answer to that is the evidence was that repeatedly throughout the case, there was a non-checking of electronic filings by the attorney. So the willfulness comes from the intentional not checking what's going on in your case. And one of the, I'm out of time, but I'll finish my sentence if I may. One of the biggest evidences of that is her filing on May 14, 2009, when she acknowledged that she had not checked the filings to even know the judgment had been entered back in November. That's a five, almost 6 month period of time without checking. So the willfulness comes from not checking the electronic filings in your case.
Counsel, I know you're out of time, but I have another question.
Yes.
Is there a finding by the court that Ms. Morris's conduct was offensive to the authority and dignity of the court? And if so, exactly where in the record is that finding?
It is not explicit. I think it's implied when the court found beyond a reasonable doubt that she had committed a punitive contempt.
Well, there is a finding, for example, that her conduct was willful, but that's not the same thing. It's a separate requirement.
That requirement was not met explicitly in either order. I agree with that. The question is it implied when the court made a finding beyond a reasonable doubt of the punitive contempt? Or does the question becomes, obviously, or does the court have to state, and I find this offensive to the dignity of the court?
Well, it seems to me it ought to be stated. I mean, because it's a separate element and it has separate considerations involved from the other elements. Mm-hmm. I mean, a person may very well act willfully, and yet what they did not offend the authority and dignity of the court. So I guess what I'm saying is it should be expressed. It should be explicit. We don't have it here. It seems to me it's required. If we decide that that's a problem, what do we do about it?
In that situation, you'd probably have to remand for consideration as to whether the court found it offensive to the dignity of the court. What the court actually stated is the court finds beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant is in contempt of court. And so I agree with you. Better practice is to state, and the court finds this to be offensive to the dignity, finds the defendant's conduct to be offensive to the dignity of the court, or some of the other language that's also in Rule 107. That's not the only language there. But there's so many times when courts make, when this court finds that certain specific findings don't have to be made, the question is, does that specific finding have to be made, or can one conclude that it was there from the other findings of the court? And on behalf of the court, I would argue the latter, that it can be concluded that the court found it offensive when the court imposed punitive sanctions. Thank you.
Thank you.
I obviously have to be brief, but I would take exception respectfully to what my opposing counsel has stated. Allegations of the past pattern were absolutely different from this situation. Ms. Morris had fallen down, had a, and I'm not sure, closed head injury of a concussion of some sort, did take for quite a period of time to regain her ability to focus on her practice. And
is that all in the record?
It was certainly in the dialogue at the hearing, and I believe it is elsewhere in some of the pleadings. So when we say that there's a continuing habit of not showing up, I think that's inaccurate. It's not just for not showing up. She had, like I said, it was a concussion that was diagnosed back in October, and that is why it did take her some period of time to get her feet back underneath her. As well, there was a motion to quash that was filed after the contempt, and that was due to the clerk calling in describing to Ms. Morris that there had been a warrant arrested. As to the second notice by opposing counsel, and I know I'm out of time.
I
would appreciate that. The notice by opposing party just gave a date, didn't give any did not contain any notice of the contempt allegations or anything of that nature. So that notice to me had no indication about Ms. Morris's conduct of what was expected or what she was being called into court for. And so those are situations that I think should be brought to this court's attention. You know, a failure to appear because you're sick, I think the case law in at least our brief is riddled with exceptions to that. There are other cases in there where district attorney doesn't appear because he's in a different argument. There's a case that we argued as well that an attorney was there talking with the court stating, yes, I can be here on such and such a day, when in fact he ended up being somewhere else arguing. And in all those instances, the attorney was not found in contempt. It is certainly our position that contempt by e-service is not good services required under the rules. 7 days to respond is also not the correct amount of time, and that we should have been provided the 20 days. The court even states in its second order that she didn't have the actual notice, and should she be held to a standard different than just Joe Layman on the street, that, hey, I should just know about this. And are we going to therefore change our rules now that I'm filing contempt against my client, and service by e-service to me as the attorney is going to be good enough service on the client? And I think not. And I think that's what the court needs to look at in this situation is actual notice versus personal service and all those things. I think they're all very much intertwined. And I agree that the court did not make the finding that the conduct was offensive to the authority and dignity of the court, nor did it interfere with the administration of justice. The issue was the creditor's interrogatories, and they'd already been dealt with. So there really wasn't anything other than perhaps a status conference that was going on, maybe to wrap up some loose ends, something of that nature, but it certainly wasn't willful on Ms. Morris's perspective to interfere with any of that. Like I stated, it was a case to her that was essentially closed. So,
okay, counsel.
And just as a closing argument, I would just say the actual notice of an order does not mean willful noncompliance. And I think that's something that the three of you need to look at. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course. That concludes.